From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Aetna-CVS merger.
So it's simpler. It's customized for the individual based on what they need. And it's cheaper.
We'll take a look at the detailed pros and cons of how the merger could change healthcare delivery for millions. Also today, the Supreme Court hears argument in the so-called gay wedding cake case.
The fact that somebody objects to the message that equal treatment sends doesn't give him a First Amendment right to opt out.
Forcing people to violate their convictions is just something that the Constitution doesn't permit.
And the legacy of Good Will Hunting 20 years later.
Do you like apples?
Yeah.
Well, I got a number. How do you like them apples?
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's take a look at the proposed merger between Woonsocket, Rhode Island-based CVS Health and Aetna. Aetna being one of the nation's largest health insurers. Now, this is a big proposal, some $69 billion, and with it, of course, come big questions, such as how could it change healthcare delivery for millions of Americans, and could it make things more or less expensive? Here's how CVS Chief Executive Larry Merlo answered on CNBC yesterday.
It's really the perfect time to bring these two companies together to create a new healthcare platform that can be easier to use and less expensive for consumers and really create a new front door to healthcare in our country.
Sounds great, but, you know, CEOs almost always have a very rosy outlook for their mega mergers. Not everyone agrees that the deal could be great for consumers, and we're talking about a lot of people here. CVS has nearly 10,000 drugstores and 1,100 walk-in clinics. Aetna covers 22 million Americans. So let's get some down-the-middle analysis from Craig Garthwaite. He leads the Health Enterprise Management Program at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. He joins us on a slightly shaky phone line, but Craig Garthwaite, we're glad that we could have you anyway. So welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let me just get right to what I think is, you know, a big question about the CVS-Aetna merger. Most of the time in the healthcare industry, whenever we've seen consolidation, people have said that generally that's not good for customers. It tends to drive prices up. Could that happen in this case?
I mean, it certainly could happen. I don't think it's the first thing we would look at here. The first thing we want to think about is that this is what we refer to as a vertical, not a horizontal merger. This is not about two hospitals in the same city joining and then trying to charge higher prices. This is about a vertical merger where we think about a supplier either being bought by its customer or a customer buying its supplier. And so it leads to different economic theories as to why we might see benefits and also different potential harms.
Okay, so let's talk through some of those benefits and harms. What do you think are the potential advantages?
So the potential benefits, there are a couple avenues we might see. The first thing we need to realize is that CVS Health is much more than just the retail pharmacy that we think of, right? So we often think of CVS as comparable to Walgreens, but they're actually a much bigger company than that. And so on the one hand, they have a very large pharmacy benefit management business, and these are often referred to as PBMs. And basically, you should think of this as the person that does your prescription drug insurance. And so they go by names like Caremark, which is owned by CVS, and Express Scripts, and Optum. And so they do your prescription drug insurance. Your health insurer does your medical insurance. And when you see the doctor, you go to the hospital. And there are definitely some theories that we have that if one firm actually controlled both of these functions, if they're responsible for figuring out how you got access to prescription drugs and how you accessed medical services, they might make a more coordinated or better decision.
Right. So just streamline that. Yeah.
Exactly. A simple way of thinking about this, and it gets more complex than this, but basically think of someone who's a diabetic. If I'm only responsible for paying for your diabetes medications, I'm probably going to set a relatively higher copayment rate on that than if I'm also responsible for when you don't take your medicine because your copay is too high, you end up in the hospital. And so if I'm responsible for all of your medical services, I'm going to think differently and try and provide a better, more cohesive benefit. And we do see evidence of that in the Medicare program, that when insurers through Medicare Advantage cover both your doctor's visits and your prescription drugs. They make different decisions about how you access the pharmacy.
Okay, so let me ask you a question then from sort of maybe a different perspective about pharmacy benefit management. If you are a drug manufacturer or a pharmaceutical company, are you looking at this and saying, maybe this isn't so great for us? Because if they're streamlining, could it mean that they want to pay less for certain drugs?
Well, I mean, they certainly want to pay less now, but
yeah.
It's not, you know, we always want to pay less. I will note, though, and we have some articles on this that suggest that if you're a pharmacy benefit manager now that's on its own, like an Express Scripts, right, you own neither pharmacies nor do you own a health insurer. There are some incentives that are built into the market that at the margin make you want to have a high list price. That's sort of the price we see in the news all the time for a drug.
Yep.
And a big rebate, which is sort of how we get a discount from the pharmaceutical manufacturer for that. Because while I pass some of that rebate on to the insurance company, I keep some myself. And so at the margin, there are incentives for list prices to be higher. And that matters because a lot of us pay for our co-insurance for prescription drugs. Right, the percentage of the cost that we have to pay ourselves as customers are based on the list price, not the post-rebate price. So there could be some real advantages to the customer, actually, of eliminating that external middleman and having it all be part of the same company.
Okay. So that has to do with, you know, sort of the pharmacy side of CVS. Now, they're also talking about, you know, perhaps a merger like this could, for in at least some places, reduce the cost of treating chronic illnesses because it would give patients better access or quicker access to sort of that kind of care. If you could just, you know, go across the street to your CVS instead of having to go to a hospital or to your doctor. Is that too rosy a scenario?
Well, I think that's certainly the one of the goals of this merger. If you listen to the company call describing the merger, both the CEOs of CVS and Aetna described about this expanded retail footprint. So anyone who's been in a CVS recently over the past few years has noted that they've been changing from really a true retail pharmacy and attempting to become more of a healthcare source, right? So they stopped selling cigarettes. They opened all these minute clinics. The idea is that if they expanded that and coordinated with your insurer, they could provide places for you to go in between doctor's visits if you're someone who has a chronic condition. And really what we're thinking about here is that to make that work requires an investment from both the insurance company and the owner of the retail clinics. But we're not really sure who's going to get the most benefit from this in terms of reduced savings and extra revenue. And so each of those players doesn't want to really make the investment unless they know they're going to get the full benefit. And so there's a strong argument that if these firms were merged together, they wouldn't be worried about who's going to benefit from each incremental investment because it would all stay within sort of the corporate infrastructure. And we might end up in a better spot. That's certainly the goal. That's the pitch that these companies are making as to how this is going to create value.
Okay, so if I could just jump in here, because I'm trying to – this is actually quite a complicated thing, and I'm trying to wrap my head around – what might be a concrete example that would help us understand the meaning of this merger? And I'm just going to make up one. I don't think this has ever actually happened in real life. But is it fair to say that it's comparable to, say, an auto insurance company merging with an auto manufacturer? And so then, you know, the same place you get your driver's insurance would be the same place you buy your car from?
I would think of it, if you want to, I would think of it more of like an automobile insurer merging with the repair shop.
Merging with the
repair shop. Which Progressive has done in places.
Okay.
In which maybe they were worried about cutting out potentially some fraud or something like that.
I see. So for the consumer, though, then at the end of the day, I mean, is that a good or a bad thing? Because maybe in the auto repair shop example, I mean, would folks be worried that, you know, maybe they would be directed towards the kinds of repairs that aren't necessarily what they need?
Yeah, so here what we'd really be worried about, right, given the structure of it, is that at the margin we create the incentive to provide less medical care to you, right? So if we talk about, you know, what we want from value-based care, we want to move away from fee-for-service medicine as we make the provider sort of, here's a fixed amount of money they treat this patient, and the more you treat them, the less profit you get. And so we worry about sort of an under-provision of medical services in these markets. And this is something we see, right, this is not the first time we've seen something like this. Right? Kaiser Permanente in California right? They are a provider-sponsored health plan, which has some of the similar ideas of what we're talking about here, where the insurer and the provider are owned by the same person. So we'd worry about that. The second thing we worry about here is that we're making the business of being a health insurer actually quite complicated. To be an insurer now, let's imagine a world in which this works for CVS, and it works for the other person following down this path, which is United Health Group, right, which also owns its own PBM and owns its own providers. That means that any new entrant to insurance that really wants to compete with these firms has got to be both an insurance company, a PBM, and own a set of retail clinics.
Right.
That's just really hard to do, and that might mean that we get less competition in the insurance market. And so even if CVS were successful, right, and they actually did get lower medical costs, they would keep those as profits rather than having them go to lower premiums, because there's no competitive force that forces them to lower premiums to get your business.
I see. Okay.
And so that's where we actually would have some worry that we would get to the, quote, value-based care we want, whatever that means to you. Right, we would get to that outcome, but it still wouldn't lower premiums because we wouldn't have a healthy, robust, competitive insurance market.
I see. Now, just to stay on this point for one more second,
sure.
Is it possible that Aetna then, again, for the sheer sort of dollar and cents aspect of this, is it possible that Aetna would say to its patients, really, we want you to go to CVS first? And in some cases, people ought to be going to their doctors or their hospitals, but they're told to go to CVS first, or they're encouraged to.
Yeah, we would be worried about that as well. We would note, though, that if going to CVS first meant that you would have a worse medical outcome, Aetna's on the hook for that. So if going to CVS meant that you're more likely to show up in the hospital, for example, right? That's going to be a cost to Aetna as the insurer. And so in that setting, given that they are interested in lowering your medical spending, I'm not super worried about that.
Okay.
I think they will push you to go to CVS for things that you could go to another similar provider, and they want to retain you within the CVS family, partly because they want to coordinate your access to medical care. If you think about the most successful examples we think about this, like an Intermountain Healthcare or a Kaiser Permanente in California, you only get service from their facilities.
Right.
But that's the name of the game. Right? And then they can coordinate your access to care and hopefully provide better health outcomes.
Okay. But it's the specter of HMOs, right? I mean, suddenly.
No, listen, it's in HMOs, but if we want to move to a place in which we're coordinating benefits, then you're going to have fewer choices. Your choice is going to be sort of in the beginning as to what set of doctors you want, but that's where we're going to be. I think overall, the thing we want to think about with the merger, I know there's been a lot of people who are quite skeptical of this merger, and I've tried as I can to sort of talk about that there are positives and negatives here. But if we are moving to a world in which we're trying to change the nature of healthcare, right, this idea where we pay for health as opposed to utilization of healthcare services, we have to think that the current firms we have are not organized in the right way to compete in this new environment. Right? They were developed to compete in fee-for-service medicine. And so we're going to have a series of mergers and a series of probably divestitures where firms bring on new assets and activities and they get rid of old things they used to do. And we're going to see a reorganization of the healthcare system along that line.
Yeah,
I think that what we've seen from United Healthcare, what we've seen from CVS Aetna in this announced merger, what we saw from Anthem announcing that they were going to stop working with Express Scripts as their PBM and now do that themselves, these are all the beginnings of this reorganization of healthcare.
So let me ask you one last question about about that point, since you're talking about reorganization of healthcare. And this may not be, you know, at the core of why CVS wants to merge with Aetna, but people are also talking about Amazon moving into the pharmacy business, and that, you know, this could be something of a protective move by CVS to sort of prepare for that future.
Yeah, I mean, people have definitely talked about that. I am less sort of optimistic about that being part of this. I do think that Amazon appears to be sniffing around the edges of pharmacy. I don't see, one, exactly how that threatens what CVS is doing in terms of its PBM business. It's going to take a long time for Amazon to get to that point.
Well, Craig Garthwaite leads the Health Enterprise Management Program at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Supreme Court today heard oral argument in a case that asks if the First Amendment protects a Colorado baker from creating a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Now, this originally took place back in 2012. Charlie and David Mullins sought to purchase a cake from Masterpiece Cake Shop in Colorado. Owner Jack Phillips said he did not support same-sex marriage because of his religious beliefs and could not make a cake to celebrate such a marriage. But Phillips did say he would be happy to sell the couple other items. Well, the case has made its way all the way up to the nation's highest court, and outside the Supreme Court today, David Mullins described how he felt after Phillips refused to sell to them.
I cried. Charlie cried. We were hurt and felt rejected, and we felt like second-class citizens in our society.
So this case raises the question of whether Phillips had the right to refuse based on his religious beliefs about same-sex marriage, or if he violated things like public accommodations laws, which require businesses to serve the public without discriminating based on race, gender, religion, or, in some states, sexual orientation. Today, Phillips himself said he believes it's the government that's rejecting his rights.
It's hard to believe that the government is forcing me to choose between providing for my family and my employees and violating my relationship with God. That is not freedom. That is not tolerance.
So let's take a closer look at what happened at the court today. Joining us is David French. He's an attorney and senior writer for National Review. David French, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you. Also with us is Jenny Pizer, Senior Counsel and Director of Law and Policy at Lambda Legal. Jenny Pizer, welcome to you as well.
Great to be with you.
It's great to have both of you, and thank you both in advance for joining us. Let's just start out with sort of your basic take on really what is at stake or what is at question in this case. I mean, Jenny Pizer, is this a First Amendment case or is it a civil rights case?
Well, it's definitely not really about cake. You know, it's about whether all of us will have the right to be treated equally when we're shopping to purchase goods or services in the public marketplace. It's actually not at all a new idea that some people have strong religious or other views for why they want to turn some customers away. But we have dealt with it repeatedly in the past about race, also about sex, when people have had strong religious views that women shouldn't do certain jobs, shouldn't be paid the same, unmarried couples shouldn't live in certain apartments. So we all have rights to believe, absolute rights to believe and to speak. But when you're operating a business that's open to the public, you have to serve the whole public, and you can't turn some people away just because of who they are. Hmm. You know, that's not a new idea, but it's a really, really important idea in our pluralistic society.
Well, let me get David French's take on this. Your thoughts on that, David?
Yeah, this is not about sexual orientation non-discrimination law. It's not about race discrimination law, sex discrimination law, or public accommodation law. It's about compelled speech. So, for example, you know, let's think of a recent public controversy. When Donald Trump was inaugurated, there were inaugural balls, and a number of fashion designers said that they would never want to design a dress for Ivanka or Melania Trump because they didn't want to use their artistic talent, use their artistic expression to support a political family they disagreed with. Now, that's no more, that's First Amendment protected speech, how they use their artistic talent, even if they're doing so in the marketplace. And it's not discriminating against Melania and Ivanka on the basis of gender or sex to deny them a dress, a specifically designed dress, simply because women disproportionately wear dresses. Traditionally, in the United States, for generations, artistic professionals have been protected from having to use their artistic talent to advance a message they disagree with. This
so can I just jump
a
in
foundational
here?
Compelled speech issue.
Yeah, so Dave, forgive me for interrupting, but I just want to jump in with
sure.
the question because I'm wondering, though, in this, so we don't really know what would have happened to those designers if they had been asked to make such a dress because they weren't. But here in this case, we do have a businessman who also considers himself an artist with his cakes, having been asked to create something for this couple. But I guess what I'm wondering is, I mean, Colorado does have a public accommodations law that says a business cannot discriminate based on sexual orientation. And isn't that what happened here? Because he was ultimately in a business to sell the cakes.
No, he was not discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation. He's long and happily served LGBT customers in a variety of contexts and would have actually sold a cake to the LGBT customers in this context. The question was, would you custom design something in a circumstance that you would be compelled to participate in an event that violates your rights of conscience? That is compelled speech. So, for example, this guy has refused to custom design Halloween cakes, bachelor party or bachelorette cakes. He's a pretty strict guy on that. But he has always served people regardless of sexual orientation, regardless of race, gender. What he objects to is to use his services in support of messages he doesn't like. The question isn't about identities of people.
So let me get a response from Jenny Pizer. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, so the first question is, what is a public accommodation? So if you have an elite artist who does not offer to make dresses or cakes or whatever for everyone, they're not a public accommodation. So if somebody refuses, you know, the kind of designer that he's talking about, same as people keep talking about Michelangelo, I mean, no offense to Jack Phillips, but he's not Michelangelo. He offers to make cakes generally for everyone, but not for same-sex couples. So, of course, that's discrimination. He gets to decide what he makes, but not for whom he makes it, if he's offering it for the general public. So, you know, he doesn't do Halloween cakes for everyone. That's fine. That's consistent with the law. But if he chooses to make wedding cakes, he has to sell them to everyone because he is a store that offers his cakes generally to everyone, just not for those people. One of the important things here is that it certainly is discrimination. He has said, well, he doesn't discriminate against gay people. He offers to sell cookies or pie. But that's a little bit like saying, well, I'll hire women, but just to work in the back office, not to be in the front office. Or the barbecue case about race discrimination and religious rights that the Supreme Court decided quite a while ago, where the Piggy Park restaurant was willing to provide takeout to African-American customers, but they couldn't sit in the restaurant. Well, of course it's discrimination. The point is equal needs to be equal for everyone. That's what Colorado law says. And it's not a speech problem if people comply with the law. Engaging in conduct because the law requires it does not mean you agree with the law.
Yeah.
I mean, how many of us agree with the tax law?
So let me,
you know, or paying our taxes doesn't mean we agree.
I want to turn back to David French on this point because, you know, I'm wondering, many times the purpose of a Supreme Court case or a case that reaches the highest court is to help, you know, us as a nation figure out where to draw these legal lines. So, David, let me just ask you, I mean, what if Mr. Phillips had, you know, if a mixed race couple had come into the store and asked for a cake? Of course, you know, mixed race marriages have been legal in the United States for many decades now. But he had said it's against my religious beliefs for couples of different races to marry. I mean, would that be okay? But based on your argument, it sounds like you'd be okay with that too.
Well, his argument to the Supreme Court was different. His argument to the Supreme Court was that there is a different level of compelling governmental interest when race is involved. However, my argument is you do not compel the creative speech of artists, period. So there is not a situation in which compelled speech, it is appropriate for the government of the United States to compel creative expression. So, for example, you know, in extreme emergency moments in our country's history, such as the middle of World War II, the federal government, the Supreme Court held that the federal government couldn't compel people to salute the flag, say the Pledge of Allegiance at a time when national unity was something that was going to help preserve our national existence. When we're talking about compelled speech, that is violating a red line in free speech jurisprudence. And one thing I would note that's about the facts here, he would actually custom design and has custom design products for LGBT folks, but just not custom design a cake for a same-sex wedding. He would do it for other occasions.
So Jenny Pizer, turning back to you here, it does make me wonder, given the line of reasoning that David French is saying that Phillips brought to the court today, some of the justices asked, okay, well, if that's the case, then, you know, who else is an artist? How else do we define people who would use this reasoning to protect their actions based on a free speech argument?
Well, I think that is a real problem because there's an enormous amount of creativity in producing certain kinds of goods and services, and that's a good thing. I mean, we've already mentioned clothing. Certainly, there are high-end restaurants where there's an enormous amount of talent and artistry that goes into it, making all kinds of products. There's creativity. There's investment by a person in creating a beautiful thing. But if the rule is going to be anytime somebody creates a beautiful thing, they have a free pass to ignore the civil rights laws, we have a real problem. And the amicus brief, the friend of the court brief that we did, was to bring to the court the enormous range, unfortunately, of discrimination that LGBT people experience in life. It literally is from cradle to grave, medical services to funeral services, and all kinds of things in between, from restaurants to lodging to all kinds of things, because people have all kinds of beliefs. That's why the rule has been and has to remain, it must remain, that our freedom to believe and to speak is absolutely protected, but not our freedom to act based on the beliefs, and especially when it's to the detriment of other people.
Right.
We won't have a society that's open to everybody if we go down this line that then allows people to opt themselves out of the civil rights laws. That leads to segregation, and we mustn't have to learn that lesson again.
So we've just got under a minute to go. David French, let me turn back to you to get your response to what Jenny Pizer said, because I think a lot of people may be wondering that. Like, say the court does decide in favor of Phillips. We obviously don't know what the court's going to do, but say hypothetically they did. I mean, could that decision provide legitimacy that would allow many other businesses to use the same reasoning to then refuse to serve same-sex couples?
Now, this is easy. The Supreme Court can reaffirm civil rights case law, including the case laws that prohibit identity-based discrimination, while at the same time reaffirming case law that protects an individual from engaging in compelled speech. And one of the things here that is important to remember is, let's look at this actual case. In this actual case, the same-sex couple, the gay couple at their event, their cake was a rainbow cake. Now, nobody can say that a rainbow cake in this context doesn't communicate a specific social, political, religious meaning, in the same way that if you ask, say, an African-American baker to bake a Confederate flag cake, that's using your talents to communicate a specific meaning in a cultural, social, political, religious context. You can protect people's rights to be free of forced speech. At the same time, you protect people from identity-based discrimination. In fact, that's been the default for American law for many, many generations. To change that and rule against the baker here would be to change the law.
Okay, so we're going over time here for a second, but Jenny Pizer, I just wanted to give you one last chance to respond to that, because what David French said was very similar to what the U.S. Solicitor General said in court today, saying, you know, we shouldn't compel a black artist to make something that would celebrate the Klan, for example. Your thought on that.
Sure. But they did not ask for a rainbow cake. Later, somebody gave them a rainbow cake. They wanted a cake like the cakes that Jack Phillips makes for everybody else. So the baker gets to decide what he makes, but not for whom or to whom he sells it. And they wanted one of the kinds of things that he makes for everybody else. That's all they wanted. And that's what they should have been able to get, just like anybody else.
Well, Jenny Pizer, Senior Counsel and Director of Law and Policy at Lambda Legal, thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And David French, attorney and senior writer for the National Review, thank you as well for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, moving on to taxes. The GOP tax overhaul bill continues its march towards President Trump's desk. Republicans hope to get it there before the holiday break. Here's the president earlier this afternoon in the Roosevelt Room talking about where the bill stands.
Last night was very smooth, and I think we're going to make it so that it comes out very beautifully. I call it the mixer. It's a conference where everyone gets together, and they pick all the good things and get rid of the things they don't like.
Well, the speed at which the House and Senate have passed the most significant rewrite of the U.S. tax code since the mid-1980s has stunned some in Washington and many other people around the country. Raising my hand, me too. So how unusual is this speediness, and how has the rush affected what's actually in the bill? For the answer to that, let's turn to Evan Horowitz. He writes the Quick Study column for the Boston Globe, and he joins us every other Tuesday to talk us through data. Hi, Evan.
Hey, Magna. I missed you last time.
Oh, well, thanks. Well, we're here now to talk taxes, our favorite topic.
You sure you don't want to talk cake?
No, taxes.
Okay,
let's stick with taxes. Okay, so here's the thing. This tax cut passed the House and especially the Senate in lightning speed. You looked at the two other major ones that people have been pointing to, 1981 and 1986, right?
And also 2001.
There was that one, too.
Yeah, there was another one, too, yeah.
So how do they compare?
So the surprising thing for me when I looked at it is actually when you pass tax cuts, you pass them pretty quickly. In 81, Reagan came into office in January. He had a tax cut on his desk by the end of July. And if you don't remember, there was an assassination attempt and a recovery in between these 7 months. George W. Bush came in office also January. He had a tax cut bill signed by June. Sometimes these things really only take a matter of months. And in that regard, this package isn't actually moving that much faster than earlier tax cuts.
Evan, I'm shaking my head here. let me just say, like, I get it, but I can't even, right? Because in none of those cases did a 400 plus page bill land on the desks of senators hours before a vote. Some of those amendments being written in by hand in an illegible way that couldn't even enter the record.
Yeah, there are differences, aren't there?
Yeah.
I mean, I did see a great Twitter take that the Declaration of Independence was written by hand, and that turned out okay. Maybe we should just write everything by hand. In any event, yeah, there are big differences. The biggest of them being that this isn't just a tax cut. It's a lot easier to quickly design a working tax cut where you just lower rates for people. You lower rates and it costs money and that's fine, and you can do it relatively quickly without great risks. But that's not what the Republicans are doing. They're doing some mix of tax cuts and tax reforms, that is, changing major pieces of the tax code, the corporate taxes, individual taxes, the estate tax, the alternative minimum tax, lots and lots of moving pieces. And when you start moving all these pieces around, well, then you need a lot of time. You need time to figure out what the interaction is between all your changes, and they're not really being deliberate about that.
Yeah, I mean, how much time should we expect that to take? Weeks? Months? I mean,
okay, so let's back to 86. 86 is the year. So Reagan did two major tax bills during his tenure. The tax cuts in 81, those were fast, fast, fast. The tax reform in 86, that took several years, 2 to 3 years.
Well, in part because of what happened in 81.
Right? Because there were actual errors in the 81 tax bill that needed to get fixed. But even if that hadn't happened, a tax reform on the scale of what he was doing, that is, lower rates for everyone, but don't lose any money. How do you lower rates for everyone and not lose money? Well, you better find all your loopholes and close them and eliminate tax breaks and make sure everyone's paying. But then you better check that, you know, you don't create new loopholes. So we're talking about hundreds of hours of hearings in Congress and independent reports leading up to it. So I think you should expect to see at least 12 to 18 months of lawmaking for something like what the Republicans are considering, not... Well, however, depending on how you measure it, something like 8 or 9 months, like what we've had.
Right. Lawmaking, deliberation, debate.
Open hearings. Expert testimony. And also having maybe some belief in the experts who are telling you things. That is, even when they do hear, like from the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is their own group.
I was going to say, using the same methodology they've always wanted these kind of bills to be scored by.
For a long time. Then they say, no, those experts are wrong. So not only there's sort of a lack of expert testimony, and then there's a lack of interest in the expert testimony when it does come forward. This creates problems. Has created specific problems. Happy to give examples.
Well, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. And then I'm going to jump back to 1981 for a minute, but give us some specific examples.
So the big one that's getting attention now is the corporate alternative minimum tax. So basically, it's this backstop in the law that's designed to prevent corporations from using so many tax breaks that they don't pay anything in taxes, right? And it works okay now. The standard corporate tax rate is 35%. The alternative minimum rate is about 20%. And originally, what they were going to do in the new bill is drop the regular rate to 20% and get rid of the alternative rate. Fine. Then, in the wee hours of the morning, they decide, well, we need a little bit of extra money. Let's keep the alternative minimum in. But that creates a huge problem because now the regular rate is 20%, the alternative minimum rate is 20%, and corporations can't take any of their tax deductions and tax credits for things like research and development. And so the corporate world is up in arms, and you may not – however much sympathy you have for that, maybe none, it's still the kind of thing that should have been thought through in a matter of weeks and months, not minutes and hours.
Right. And because it's not being thought through, it creates all this uncertainty. It creates unexpected consequences. And again, I'm thinking back to 1981. One of the consequences – I mean, I suppose people might say – some of these were expected, but we had an exploding deficit after that. And again, 86 had to come around in order to partially, you know, account for that.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't surprising in a sense.
No.
We were, you know, when you cut taxes, you lose money. The government loses money. I mean, I know there's all this argument about how much they lose. You lose. But it does. Tax cuts don't pay for themselves. They never have. They're not going to. All the credible projections of this say maybe they'll pay for, they'll make up about a third of the lost money. So in 81, they cut taxes dramatically. Like the top tax rate went from 70% to 50%. That's a huge drop. And yeah, deficits spiked. So that's going to happen again too, because we are also cutting taxes as part of this sort of mild tax reform bill that's racing through now.
You know, I was like many, perhaps you too, Evan, was up into the wee hours of the morning watching the Senate do its thing on C-SPAN.
I couldn't look away. I mean, it was one of these things where, you know, people are ready to vote, but they haven't seen the bill. And I want to see the bill also, because I like to understand what they're voting on, because I'm probably going to have to write about it 14 minutes after they vote on it.
Yeah.
And
so you'll have gotten
up
14 more minutes than the senators did to look at the bill itself. And speaking to that point, Maine Senator Angus King had some strong words for the whole process that went down in the Senate last week, and he coined a new term during the floor debate last Thursday.
I have a new rule I'm proposing today. I'm calling it modestly King's Law. King's Law is the faster a bill goes through this body, the worse it will be.
That's Angus King from Maine there. We've got about a minute to go here, Evan. Let me just ask you, from what you've been able to look at in the Senate bill, what do you think some of the long-term effects might be?
So I find this kind of fascinating because we have short-term and long-term questions, big questions. Most of the – well, the biggest hit of stimulus comes like maybe 2 years in, so 2019. That's when the corporate tax kicks in, so you can see a big hit. So the question is like, what is the state of the economy going to be in 2019? Mm. Are we going to need stimulus then? We don't need it now. We're at full employment. So if we're close to full employment then the impact of the tax cut will depend on what the Fed does. Big stimulus. If you're already at full employment, the Fed's going to determine everything. They say, well, let's just raise rates. We'll offset everything. So it depends on this weird timing where what matters is what's the state of the economy in 2019, and we have no idea what it's going to be. And then the economic effects, they taper off.
Right.
So the biggest effects is early, years two, year three. By year 10, you're down to a sort of unrecognizably small impact.
Except if you're a corporation or a big earner, then you're
on the overall economic pie, not on the distribution. Yeah, absolutely true.
Well, Evan Horowitz, the Quick Study columnist for the Boston Globe. It's always great to have you, Evan.
Thank you, Meghna. I love coming on.
I love talking about taxes with you. I really do. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My, how quickly time flies, because it's been 20 years since we first saw this.
Do you like apples?
Yeah.
Well, I got a number. How do you like them apples?
Really, do we need to say anymore? Of course that's Good Will Hunting, the tug at your heartstrings Boston flick about a 20-year-old math genius who also happens to be a South Boston janitor who's got to go see about a girl. Now, that movie made $225 million. It also launched Matt Damon and Ben Affleck into stardom. And it cemented an almost indestructible Boston stereotype into the American imagination. So how well has the movie aged, and what is its real legacy? Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe, has some answers to these questions, and he joins us now. It's great to see you, Ty.
Thanks, Meghna. Great to be here.
Okay, so how well does Good Will Hunting hold up 20
years
later?
You know, I approached watching this movie 20 years on, and I don't think I might have seen it once or twice in the intervening 20 years, with trepidation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, have we held on to our innocence? You know what? The movie still works. The movie's, and in fact, it's almost painfully good and it's almost painfully emotional to look back at a time when Ben and Matt both seemed like best buddies and both seemed young and we were young and the world was rosy and South Boston seemed like a novel place for the movies to go to.
Right. And there's a very dewy-eyed Casey Affleck in there too,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. I mean, he's like practically in diapers.
Practically with a curly mop of hair right on the top of his head. So what is it about the film, though, that seemed to it captured something about Boston that hadn't been told in that way or as effectively before for a mass audience.
Right. And I think credit partially has to go to director Gus Van Sant, who it's probably one of the most commercial movies of his career, but he was known for celebrating outsiders. And in this movie, these two kids from Southie are kind of like the ultimate Boston outsiders. And one of them gets this chance to break into, you know, the Institute, MIT. He's an MIT janitor who solves an equation on a chalkboard. And, oh, my God, he's a genius. And Stellan Skarsgård is the sleazy professor.
Oh, yeah. He looks quite different now.
Yes, he does.
In the current context.
Tries to bring him into the fold and then takes him to Robin Williams as the shrink. But it really is about the character's roots in this novel country that the movies had never really explored in depth. They'd gone there a number of times, but never really gone into the culture of it, the anthropology of it. It got something about Boston that few movies do, which is the class divides, the barriers.
Absolutely. Well, so to that point, I mean, one of my favorite scenes from the movie is the famous or infamous Harvard bar scene.
Yes.
Right? And, of course, it's where Ben Affleck is going up to Minnie Driver and, you know, he's trying to pick her up, but he gets called out for his class by a university student. And then Matt Damon or Will Hunting swoops in to save the day with his surprising Southie genius. And here's a clip from that scene.
See, the sad thing about a guy like you is in 50 years, you're going to start doing some thinking on your own, and you're going to come up with the fact that there are two certainties in life. One, don't do that. And two, you dropped 150 grand on a education you could have got for $1.50 in late charges at the public library.
Yeah, but I will have a degree, and you'll be serving my kids fries at a drive-thru on our way to a skiing trip.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but at least I won't be unoriginal.
That scene, I have to say, it strikes me differently now.
How so?
Given the sort of economic travails that we were all thinking about than it did 20 years ago. 20 years ago, it seemed very heartfelt and uplifting. But now, you know, I hear Will Hunting there being like, yeah, at least I won't be unoriginal. I wonder how many people in his situation now would, like, that would be their comeback, really.
it's an angry role.
Yeah.
And it's funny to watch Matt Damon in this, A, because he's about half the size he is now. Not to say that he's huge, but he just was really skinny then. But it's probably one of the angriest roles that he ever played. And you forget how forceful and how really there's a hot ball of rage under this character that he has to solve to go on with life. But that rage is definitely reflective to some degree and even more of the class barrier.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the first times, I think, in movies that rage had sort of been tapped and put onto film in a way that was very sort of viscerally satisfying for audiences.
You know, so you mentioned Gus Van Sant having been the director, but I also, like, I have to say, I remember being surprised / shocked that Ben Affleck and Matt Damon wrote the screenplay, right?
Right?
They won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay
that year. I know, and it's, you know, talk about setting up expectations. I mean, and that was the fairy tale. That was the fairy tale of this movie that's still really quite moving. These, you know, kids out of nowhere who were from buddies from Cambridge, you know, went to Hollywood, they pushed it through, they got to star in it, they got it shot in Boston when a lot of the suits were saying, nah, we'll shoot it in Toronto. They got the movie made the way they wanted it made. And then it triumphed. I mean, it cost $10 million to make and made $225 million at the box office, won a bunch of Oscars. I mean,
$10 million, that's what, like, Matt Damon makes in, you know, a week on a movie set now.
Exactly.
Well, let's play another clip then from Good Will Hunting. This is a scene towards the end of the movie when Ben Affleck's character, Chucky, tells Will that Will needs to get out of Boston, right? Not necessarily for Will's own good, but for the good of his friends like Chucky. Here's what he said.
Every day I come by your house and I pick you up. We go out, we have a few drinks and a few laughs, and it's great. You know what the best part of my day is? For about 10 seconds from when I pull up to the curb and when I get to your door. Because I think maybe I'll get up there and I'll knock on the door and you won't be there. No goodbye, no see you later, no nothing. Just left.
Now, you've written about this, and you say that scenes like this play like the beginnings end? What do you mean by that?
Well, what felt like the beginning of something now when you look at this movie, because they're both really good in it. You know, Affleck gets a lot of flack for a variety of reasons. He's so good in this movie. And Damon's so good. They play really well together. And after this, everything changed. Affleck went off to become a big movie star, fell in love with Jennifer Lopez. Damon went off and did talent. Yeah, made Geely and you know, other movies of which we will not speak. Damon went off and made Talented Mr. Ripley, had a very different career. We thought that we were going to see more of them together, and we didn't. And in fact, they had careers, separate careers that we would never have predicted. So that beginning of something wonderful turned into something different.
Yeah. So I want to talk about something else that you've written about the legacy of Good Will Hunting, that perhaps the Boston movie may be a victim of Good Will Hunting's success, in that you've written that the authenticity shown in Good Will Hunting, in your words, about Boston has been slowly hammered into a cliche.
Well, you know, think about it. Hollywood loves a fresh location. And here was, an urban neighborhood, an ethnic enclave shown with what felt very fresh realism. It felt authentic. Great, let's go back there again. You know, it feels real. And so then we got Mystic River, and then we got The Departed, and then we got Gone Baby Gone, and then we got The Town, and on and on and on. And the most recent ones are the marathon bombing movies, yeah. Patriot's Day and Stronger. And The Fighter, and they're all Black Mass. They all have their strengths and weaknesses. I would argue over time, they have just hardened into cliche. And a movie like Stronger is a very good example. Jake Gyllenhaal gives a tremendous performance. The scenes with him dealing with coming back from his injuries and the bombing are very, very moving. It feels like a freshly told tale. Every time he goes in and has scenes with the character's family, you know, squawking and squabbling and these broad accents and you know, throwing F-bombs, it just feels like we've been there before. It feels like they're going to a series of stereotypes and not bringing, really shedding any new light on them.
Yeah. So to that point, I want to play one more clip. This has to do with Casey Affleck, mm-hmm. And his recent cinematic triumph in Manchester by the Sea, the 2016 Oscar-winning film. And he, of course, plays Lee, a man who's had a devastating loss in his life. And I've seen here between Casey Affleck and Michelle Williams, they play a divorced couple who went through this tragedy together.
Maybe you don't want to talk to me.
It's not that.
Let me finish. However, my heart was broken. It's always going to be broken. And I know yours is broken, too.
Now, the reason I wanted to play a clip from Manchester by the Sea, Ty, is that I think the great triumph of that movie is it takes some of the same tropes that we see in Good Will Hunting, but treats them with such tenderness and complexity, mm-hmm. and depth that it's an altogether different kind of Boston or Boston area movie, but in the same line.
Well, I completely agree, because you have squabbling families. You got, you know, the uncle and the nephew, basically, yeah. and they're yelling at each other in regional accents and throwing the F-bombs at each other. Exactly what I was just criticizing. But because partially it's set in a novel setting, slightly outside, you know, in a different city, partly because the dramatic setup is different, and partly because Kenneth Lonergan is a really good writer and director. It feels new. You feel like you're in the moment. You feel like you're not leaning on things that have been done before. I do feel that the Boston movie is starting perhaps to move in different directions, as I think it needs to, if it's going to stay vibrant, if the stories that are going to be told about what happens here are going to be reach beyond the area and touch people in other parts of the country.
I agree. And I mean, to be blunt about it, the Boston movie, I feel, I'd love to see it move beyond the sort of white male working class accented bro-y guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because That will still always be a very important part of who and what Boston is. But the city and the region have so many other really vibrant stories to tell, other vibrant stereotypes or tropes to offer the nation, that I'd love to see those made into movies.
North Shore, South Shore. I always think of it, the western suburbs. Well, that's where everybody goes to get away from drama. So, nobody will ever make a movie set in Newton, but you never know.
I still want the great commercial successful Hollywood film to come out of Roxbury.
Please.
Mattapan.
I have been saying for years that the great Boston movie has yet to be made, and it will be about busing, and nobody here will want to see it.
But everyone else should, though.
Exactly.
And honestly, we ought to see a great movie about an honest assessment of busing as well.
But I'm not holding my breath.
Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe, talking to us about the lasting legacy 20 years later of Good Will Hunting. It's really been great to have you, Ty. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Meghna.
Now, we should also acknowledge that a lot has changed since 1997. Some of it not so good. So it's important in this moment to also talk about the fact that the two Affleck brothers have faced a lot of scrutiny for their treatment of women in the years following Good Will Hunting. Casey Affleck settled two lawsuits accusing him of sexual harassment, and Ben Affleck recently apologized for his treatment of women and his association with Harvey Weinstein. Ty Burr acknowledges some of those associations in his piece that he wrote about Good Will Hunting. And you can find a link to that at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.